I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. There were efforts to legally declare a fetus a person and new Bible translations. There was also the death of Osama bin Laden. In today's pluralistic world, even stories that might never be covered by the religion desk, like armed conflicts worldwide or presidential election campaigns, have undeniably religious angles and implications. On today's program, we count down the top religion stories of 2011, from a gentler version of hell, to the criminal charges against a Kansas City Catholic bishop, to civil rights of American Muslims. We'll discuss the impact of these headline makers on believers and society at large. It's Up to Date, following this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. New stories about religion this year cut a wide swath from a controversial book that painted a picture of hell that wasn't all that harsh to new declarations that yoga isn't all that compatible with Christianity to issues with the civil rights of American Muslims. Along the way, we witnessed the death of Osama bin Laden and, in our own backyard, the filing of criminal charges against Catholic Bishop Robert Finn over failure to report suspected child abuse. He became the first active bishop in the country to face criminal prosecution in such a case. Today, we'll kick around the top religion news stories of the year, as selected by the Huffington Post and the Religion News Service. Our guest today, KCUR's Brian Ellison, is the occasional host of this program. He's a member of the Religion News Writers Association and pastor of Parkville Presbyterian Church. Brian, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Paul Rauschenbusch is senior religion editor for the Huffington Post. He joins us from his office in New York. Paul, good morning to you.
Great to be with you.
And also with us today, Kevin Ekstrom is editor-in-chief of Religion News Service. He joins us from NPR Studios in Washington, D.C. Kevin, good morning to you, too.
Good morning.
Well, how did each of you select your top religion stories of the year? And Kevin, let's begin with you. How did you come up with your top 10?
Well, this year actually was a little difficult because there was no big thing that kind of stood out. What we noticed was there's kind of a broad trend towards protests and people taking it to the streets. And you saw that everywhere from Tahrir Square in Cairo and Libya to Wall Street and even the Wisconsin State House. So this was really a year of protests. And so that kind of became the overall theme. But this is actually kind of a fun project to do, to look back. And what's weird is you don't realize just how much happened in any given year until you stop and look back.
Yeah. Paul, how about you? How did you go about picking your list?
Well, similar to Kevin, it was fun to go back and see, like, what really caught heat from the kind of absurd end of the world, which really actually became much bigger of a story, the Harold Camping story of May 21st, bigger story than anybody would have thought it would, to stories that were more continuations of stories that had started about Muslims in America. I think I agree that the big story was around the religious impetus around protest movements. And so that was a main feature in our list as well.
You know, it struck me, Brian, that neither of our guests today mentioned and picked the Tim Tebowing of America. Is that because the Tebow phenomenon sort of blew up maybe after these lists were compiled, or should it even be on the list?
Well, I think that's probably part of it, Steve, that these lists come out late in the year, and that's really been cropping up just in the last month or two. But you know, I think the other part of that is that athletes sort of publicly voicing their faith, that's not a terribly new story. Tim Tebow is the latest manifestation of it, but every few years an athlete comes along who expresses their very public faith in a very public way, sometimes with detractors and sometimes with a lot of people celebrating.
Well, Kevin, defend yourself. Why didn't you list Tim Tebow on your top 10 list?
Because I grew up in Boston, just shy of Patriots Stadium, and but frankly, I wouldn't know how to write about a football game if you paid me. Mm-hmm. But I think Brian is right. I mean, this is one of those sort of hard to gauge trends. You know, when does it start? When does it end? I think Tebow has raised a lot of sort of persistent questions about religion and sports. But I think the best take on the whole Tebow controversy was Saturday Night Live on Saturday where they had Jesus come to the Broncos locker room. I thought it was just brilliant.
Yeah. Paul, what do you think?
Oh, you know, I've mentioned that in other roundups of, you know, when speaking to people that I thought it was funny. I don't think it really – I think most of the things on our list are things that people kind of say have at least a sense of gravitas around the world. I think for most people around the world, the Tim Tebow phenomenon is just absolute mystifying, and they kind of roll their eyes. And so I'm not sure it makes all the way up there. Although if it becomes more of a phenomenon, and you know what was an interesting addition to that story was when a high school student started to Tebow and got suspended for it, and then it becomes a question of freedom of religion and how religion is expressed in the public square, and so all of those things that could turn into a bigger story.
Paul, run with that a little bit. You say it's mystifying Tebow's Tebowing around to people around the world. Why is it mystifying to them?
Well, I think the idea that God is really engaged in the question of a touchdown is not something that most of the world. I mean, it's not something that they're confronted with. I think that you know you see soccer players pointing up, but you wouldn't see such a big display of faith and such a kind of a rallying around it and the venturing into culture wars that we have in the United States. It's just not as big of a part of the culture.
Reverend Brian Ellison from the pulpit of Parkville Presbyterian Church, have you addressed the whole Tim Tebowing of America here?
You know, I haven't. You know, this is a Chiefs town, Steve. I don't think it's wise for me to get too far into Broncos religious matters. But I will say, you know, to broaden it beyond the Tebow case, I think what Paul's saying is right, that we sometimes become very consumed with particular issues and think that they're worldwide issues because they're religion issues. But it's
football.
Well, it is football, and it's very American. And I think there's probably several other issues like that on our list. Even the Harold Camping rapture predictions, you know, those are big issues in the American press for a few weeks. But you didn't see people around the world selling their cars and quitting their jobs.
Well, Kevin, I was struck that the Religion News Writers Association opted this year not to pick a Religion Newsmaker of the Year. Why not?
Well, because the voting was so close. And in my 12, 13 years being a member of Religion News Writers, it's the first time I remember that this happened. It was sort of a tie between Harold Camping and also Pope Benedict XVI and Rick Perry.
Just say I was hoping you would invite all three of them to an awards ceremony and we could see them all together. I'm sorry about that.
Well, Kevin, Tebow.
Yeah, Kevin, Rick Perry was on your finalist list?
He was for his sort of very open, very expressive, very evangelical faith in politics. He has done religion and politics in a way that we haven't seen done in a while. I mean, the expression, the ad that he just cut about sitting in the church on church pew on Sunday and things like that. You know, this was another guy, and this I think is another big story from the year, where evangelicals fell in and out of love with all of the presidential candidates on the Republican side. At first it was Michelle Bachmann, and then it was Perry, and then it was Herman Cain, and now apparently it's Gingrich. And this sort of, relationship that they can't quite nail down, it's sort of like nailing Jell-O to a wall as to who they're going to vote for. I think Perry was sort of largely emblematic of that.
Yeah. And so the voting was too close, he just couldn't pick a winner?
Yeah, there were, I believe there were, it was a virtual three-way tie with less than one vote each separating them. So, yeah, I suppose we could have done all three, but the powers that be decided that since nobody was out in front, nobody was going to get it.
Yeah. Well, Paul Rauschenbusch from the Huffington Post, let's start from one from your list. It's Mormons in Politics. Why did you go that way?
Well, you know, it's been the Representative King hearings all year. The Mormons in politics, rather. I was thinking of the Muslims in politics. Mormons in politics. Well, the big story is how Romney is negotiating his political run, less so Huntsman. But I think it's a continuation of the Perry story, which is religion and politics, how it plays out in the presidential election, which is different than, say, what Harry Reid is having to deal with in the Senate. Especially when the GOP's base is so heavily evangelical, and the traditional kind of suspicion of evangelicals of Mormonism, is it Christianity, is it not? Mm-hmm. I mean, a great moment, or a telling moment, was I guess it was an Iowa voter said, when are you going to explain to us what Mormons really believe? And Romney was like, I'm not. I mean, I really want to talk about the economy. But it's this question of, like, how much are you going to share? The more, in fact, you know, in some ways, the more Romney talks about religion, the worse it is for him. So I think it's an interesting phenomenon. Huntsman is dealing with it less because he's not really a candidate that anybody views is going to win, but it really is an issue, and like anyone who's not a Protestant, it questions like who can be president.
Mm-hmm. Brian Ellison, what do you make of this hesitancy of some voters, particularly evangelicals, to sort of hold off from backing Romney just because of his faith?
Well, you know, Steve, I think it's interesting. I think folks say, well, why would Mitt Romney have to defend Mormonism? You know, Rick Perry doesn't have to defend being Baptist all the time. You know, but I think that's actually somewhat disingenuous. Mitt Romney is not just another Mormon. Mitt Romney has been very, very active as a Mormon. He fulfilled a role in Massachusetts that was similar to the role of a bishop in other traditions. He's been very active in the faith. You know, if I ran for president, you could legitimately ask me about what Presbyterians are and what Presbyterians believe, because mm-hmm. I've had a leadership role. And I think that's something that Mitt Romney has not really addressed. And I think there is some concern for that reason. I think also, Steve, that just the general unfamiliarity, the misconceptions perhaps, and the assumptions that people make about the tradition, that's going to continue to plague him all through this race.
Kevin, do you think he'd be better off by taking on this issue of what I believe more fully, more in a front-on kind of manner, given these questions that so many voters have?
I don't think so, and I think he pretty much said last time around, he gave a pretty major speech about his faith and the role that it would play in his White House. And he said he's not going to do it. I don't think it really helps him to try to get into the whole of explaining Mormon theology, because so little of it is already understood to begin with. I think what we're seeing, and it relates to another story from this year, is sort of the perplexity and kind of fascination with Mormon weirdness, for lack of a better word. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean that disparagingly, but Mormons believe some very particular things that a lot of people find a little strange and a little weird. That's going to dog Romney until he addresses it, and I don't think he will. But you saw the kind of the flip side of that in another story, and that was the play, The Book of Mormon, on Broadway that won 12 Tony Awards, including Best Musical. And they sort of took on Mormon theology head on and did it in a way that was kind of funny and kind of irreverent and kind of obscene, but in a very tenderhearted sort of way. And to that extent, people are okay with the Mormon distinctiveness as long as somebody tries to explain it. But I don't think Romney's the guy to do it.
Well, what should voters know? I don't want to wade too deeply into this, but what should voters know about the Mormon faith? I don't know which of the three of you want to take that on, but are there two or three things that voters should be aware of?
I think what Mormons will tell you is that they are Christian. Mm-hmm. And in a classical sense, they are and they sort of aren't. Without getting too deep into theology, Mormons believe in Jesus Christ as the Savior of the world, but they don't believe in the Trinity, for example, which is a fairly foundational teaching. Mm-hmm. So, yes, they believe they're Christians, but when you have this very basic disagreement as to are they Christian, are they not, when you're arguing about that sort of basic kind of disagreement, you're not going to get very far after that into things like Mormon heaven and things like that.
And your question, Steve, is what should voters know? And quite arguably, many would say it doesn't matter. That's Christian, right, or not Christian, Christian sect or Christian mainstream, it doesn't really matter from a public policy standpoint. And now there are other sort of quieter voices that are concerned about the Mormon Church's involvement in various public policy issues. Most recently, most publicly, in Prop 8 in California about same-sex marriage. But but even that isn't something that's really been connected very directly with Mitt Romney.
Okay.
Well, and interestingly, we ran a big piece that actually came out of our politics area about, you know, that Romney probably will win the GOP nomination, but where the real questions about Mormonism will come is more from the left. And we already saw, you know, Obama's camp kind of dropped a word called weird, and that there's going to be real questions about Mormonism and how, you know, how involved the church will be in Romney's camp. And so these kind of questions, which have dogged Romney since he ran against Kennedy in Massachusetts,
right,
will continue.
The issue's not going away. All right. Well, if you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking about the top religion news stories of 2011. We're visiting with KCUR's Brian Ellison, Paul Rauschenbusch of the Huffington Post, and Kevin Ekstrom, editor-in-chief of the Religion News Service. He joins us from Washington, D.C. this morning. Let's turn to a story closer to home here. The Religion News Writers Association rated the charges against Bishop Finn here locally in Kansas City as the third biggest story of the year. This was over Finn's failure to report the suspected abuse of a child. We know this is a big story locally, Kevin. Why is it a big story nationally?
I think what we saw in 2011 was a subtle but strong shift in how this case is, and how this issue is being handled. And it's no longer being handled just by the church, and now it's entering the criminal realm, in the civil courts realm, to a degree that we haven't seen before. There's been a lot of abusive priests who have been brought up on charges of molestation, but this is the first year that we saw a bishop brought up on mishandling it. We also saw it in Philadelphia, where a top church official was indicted, and a grand jury slammed the church for keeping 30 or more active priests in ministry, despite knowing that they had some abuse in their past. And even on a long shot scale, you had victims filing charges against the Pope himself at the International Criminal Court to hold him personally responsible for not protecting children. So, yes, we're going to see, I think, more of this. A lot of prosecutors have been hesitant to take this into the courtroom, even as much as they wanted to, because when you're going up a bishop and you're going up against the hierarchy, that's a pretty explosive charge. But as we've seen in Kansas City, it can be done, and he even cut a plea deal to avoid further charges. So I think we're going to be seeing, this is just the start, I think.
Brian Ellison, how surprised were you that the prosecutor, the Jackson County prosecutor, actually opted to take on the bishop of the Catholic Church here in Kansas City?
Well, I think, as Kevin said, this marks something of a turning point. I think it was very surprising that the prosecutor was willing to take this step. The laws under which these charges were filed, these mandatory reporter laws, you know, everyone knows them. Teachers, counselors, pastors all have to follow these laws, but very rarely are charges brought under these laws. So it is very surprising. You know, I will say, Steve, that I think one of the big parts of this story, and the part that's hard to report but is very real out there, and we've seen some of it in the Star's reporting on this case, is the disconnect between that people in the pews, that parishioners seem to perceive between what they're hearing from the pulpit and from the diocese and from the church hierarchy and what they're reading in the newspaper, what they're hearing from the prosecutor's office. And they're sensing that there is some difference between what they are being officially told and what's being reported. And that itself is causing a certain degree of tension in the local church.
Paul Rauschenbusch, what effect is all of this having on the church, on the Catholic Church writ large around the country in America? Has attendance suffered? Has giving suffered? Do we have any read on that yet?
Well, the reports that I've heard are that there's, in fact, incredible hemorrhaging going on in the Catholic Church, and that if it weren't for the Latino population that continues to attend and keep the numbers up, that we would be seeing some incredible shrinkage of numbers in in the United States, but also across Europe. I think the Catholic Church in Ireland is suffering something like a third of attendance is down. So it's had a real effect. The Catholic Church is not going anywhere. Let's put it that way. And there, you know, there's been a lot of other stories. I totally agree with RNS's assessment of that story as a top one. We chose the new mass instead because that just was indicative of a broader trend within the Catholic Church of maybe going towards more traditional understandings within theology and also within the liturgy, and that it had a major effect on every Catholic who was going into the pews, and that started on the first Sunday of Advent.
Hmm. Kevin, you know, you wonder sometimes if too much attention has been focused on the abuse in the Catholic Church. You know, should the media be reporting on the problem of abuse in other churches or other institutions just as extensively, or what do you think?
Yeah, well, we certainly saw that this year with Penn State, where you had a very similar situation where something bad happened, people knew about it, and they didn't report it, essentially. And the Catholic Church has long argued that this is not just a Catholic problem, that this is a problem in schools and in the Cub Scouts and in sports and in other institutions, and that they're not alone in this. The problem with reporting it, and I'm not trying to get defensive at all, but it's a very challenging story to report because so much of it never comes to see the light of day.
Yeah.
You don't know that it's happening until a victim comes forward and says, this is what happened. And that's hard for them to do a lot of the time. And so, yes, do other institutions need to be held accountable in the same way that folks have tried to hold the Catholic Church accountable? Absolutely. I think you'll get, even prosecutors will agree that it's hard to know the extent of the problem until the people involved come forward. And what we've seen from both Penn State and the Catholic Church is that the folks involved on that side of the equation are not going to come forward voluntarily.
Right.
Well, and I think the reference to Penn State is particularly apt, and folks have made this comparison, that football at Penn State is almost a religion, that there is an entire institutional setup, a reverence that sort of makes certain people and certain parts of the institution untouchable, and where you cannot question things. And that seems to have genuinely contributed to the cover-up that's alleged at Penn State.
Mm-hmm.
I think the reason it's a bigger story in the church, Steve, is that the church is the church. The church is this institution that people have put trust in, that people find a part of their identity in, that they look to for protection and guidance. And so it's different than different than a school. It's
yeah.
it's an institution that is so foundational that when this sort of thing is alleged to have occurred, it is a big story.
You know, Paul, as we leave this story and this topic for this morning, I just want to touch base on this topic. Has the church, in your estimation, the Catholic Church, finally come to grips with this, or is there still some sense of denial or some sense of not really wanting to confront what's happened here?
I think they're getting the story. I mean, I think that there is a sense of moral outrage among the Catholic hierarchy. I mean, how can't there be? I think they are also in damage control and trying to figure out a way to make sure that people, maintain trust in the church and continue to feel like there's a place for them. So they have to still present a picture of the church as a place of that does, you know, care for the least of these, even while they deal with the fact that people are saying that they forsake the basic trust. So I think that there's a realization. I just think how they proceed is done with great care, especially in light of how people perceive the church at large.
Hmm. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our roundup here of the top religion news stories of 2011. We'll turn to the RNA's top story, religion story for 2011. We'll also talk about the Muslim Spring, the Dalai Lama, and a new translation of the Roman Missal. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And And welcome back to the second half of Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Tomorrow on the program, the best children's books of 2011. Join us for that conversation. This hour, we're talking about the best religion stories of 2011. We're visiting with KCUR's Brian Ellison. He's pastor of Parkville Presbyterian Church. Paul Rauschenbusch, who joins us from his offices in New York. He's senior religion editor for the Huffington Post. And Kevin Ekstrom, editor-in-chief of the Religion News Service. He joins us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. We haven't gotten to the top story that you all listed, Kevin, on your list from the Religion News Writers Association. The top story of the year in your estimation was what exactly?
It was the death of Osama bin Laden and some of the religious reaction that came along with that. You know, for a lot of Americans, probably a majority, the face of Islam was Osama bin Laden. Their first introduction to Islam in many ways was on 9/11 with Osama bin Laden. So his importance as a religious figure, even though people would argue that he wasn't terribly religious, but he symbolized an entire global faith for a lot of people. And when he died, when he was killed, a lot of people weren't very sad about that. What I thought was so interesting was in the couple of days after he was killed, there was this real sense of joy and elation and almost a kind of a victory in a way. But there was a lot of people who had some pause about that. You know, should we really be celebrating in the streets? Should we be jumping and shouting USA, USA? And how are we exactly supposed to feel about this? Because we're not sad that he's gone, but should we be happy about it? So there was a really interesting moral discussion that followed around his killing.
Paul, what's your sense of how Muslim communities in America managed to respond to this news?
Well, I thought, you know, Muslim communities responded like most others, where they were kind of glad to put this, you know, this symbol behind them and say this, you know, this is not the symbol we want. Actually, let us show you the symbol, which they had been trying to say for 10 years, but which, you know, it was a hard sell. And so, you know, most of the major Muslim organizations, you know, made press releases about, you know, being glad of the demise of Osama bin Laden and saying now can we move forward as full Americans and you know, be part of this society without the suspicion that this guy is somehow represents us.
Brian, a big part of this story, as Kevin just mentioned, was reaction to bin Laden's death and then the reaction to the reaction. Where did you see that secondary reaction most clearly?
Well, I mean, I think, and here, Steve, I think I kind of have to take off my small journalist hat and put on my pastor hat a little bit. What I've noted in this community I serve and in others is a real discomfort with jubilation at the death of a person. It was most striking to me when I went down to the senior high Sunday school class the Sunday after that happened. And here are kids who remember 9/11 sort of as something that happened when they were in kindergarten, first grade. You know, they knew about it, but they didn't feel it the way older people did.
Mm-hmm.
And these are folks who really reacted strongly to what they saw as a celebration of death or of someone dying.
They reacted what?
Reacted
against
negatively,
that? Yeah.
Most of them.
Mm-hmm. The kids did.
Or at least quizzically. I don't know if negative is the right word, but they didn't understand it. And that, I think, gave a lot of people of faith around the country pause, as you said, as to why in the world was this reaction one entirely of jubilation? Particularly,
how did
for
you address that with these high school kids at your church? What did you say to them?
Well, I think, I mean, I did a lot of listening. I affirmed what they were feeling, and I think there was a lot of integrity to what they were feeling
right.
and expressing. I think, you know, as a Christian, we can talk about forgiveness and grace. We can talk about justice, but we can also talk about, you know, who gets to execute justice, whether justice is something always to be celebrated.
Paul Rauschen.
You know, it was really interesting.
Kevin, go ahead.
Jump in real quick.
Yeah.
We did a poll with our partners at Public Religion Research Institute after he was killed about what people feel about it or where they think bin Laden was, and two-thirds of Americans thought that he's in hell. So fairly overwhelming majority that, you know, despite whatever qualms people had about the celebrations, they were fairly certain as to the fate of his eternal soul.
But I didn't realize people got to vote on that. That's a different approach.
Paul Rauschenbusch from the Huffington Post, you have one entry for one of your top religion stories of 2011. The Muslims are coming. The Muslims are coming. Fear of the Muslim menace, quotes around that term, fueled by cynical politicians and well-funded think tanks, has led to anti-Sharia laws proposed and passed in states around the country. What is that all about, and what are anti-Sharia laws?
Well, there was a big movement to try to propose these laws around the country that would restrict any sort of preemptively any laws that might include Sharia stipulations or laws that might be based on Sharia, and these were invariably in places where those laws had not been put forth, and so one of the interesting things that happened this year, in addition to Representative King's hearings on radical Islam, which I referenced earlier, was a report that came out about called Fear Inc., which was the kind of a revelation of major think tanks and major lobbying efforts going into kind of anti-Islamic efforts around the country. And so it was one of these kind of continuously driven stories. I think we saw it come up big time in 2010 around the Park 51 mosque, and then that immediately after the 2010 midterm elections, that just faded away. And the Park 51 has opened, and its first major exhibit was a interfaith photography exhibit by some Jew photographer. So it was just it was this kind of very trumped up story that came, and I think we're looking forward to now in 2012 to have a similar sort of fear campaign.
Kevin Ekstrom, you listed this story, a similar story, as your number two story of the year, and you wrote this: lively congressional hearings are held on the civil rights of American Muslims. In the House, hearings focus on alleged radicalism, and in the Senate, on crimes reported against Muslims. Have we only seen, just the tip of the iceberg with this story? What do you think's next here?
Actually, I think we're seeing kind of the tail end of it. The House Homeland Security Committee convened these hearings on radicalization within American Islam, and they went. What upset so many people was that they sort of went into it with the assumption that all American Muslims are radicalized or militant in some way, and we need to find a way to do it, rather than saying, "Is this a problem? How can we fight it?" They sort of went in with the assumption that they had already made up their minds. Democrats responded in the Senate by holding hearings on civil rights violations against Muslims. Now, since those two sort of key hearings earlier this year, there have been a series of others, but they've frankly been a little less interesting and gotten a lot less traction. I don't know how many more hearings Congressman King can hold on this, but he is not giving up on it. But I think it's become fairly clear that it's not going to gain a whole lot of traction on Capitol Hill in terms of being able to do much about it.
Yeah, Brian.
Well, and when we take it out to the state level, I think I would agree with Kevin's assessment that I think we're seeing this story on the downward slope as well. At that level, there were big stories about anti-Sharia legislation in some state houses. Missouri had a bill in the House. There was one in Kansas as well, but those haven't gained a lot of traction. They died in committee, even in pretty conservative chambers in both states. So it would appear to me that this story is losing traction, which should not diminish, though, the sense that Muslims in certainly in the Kansas City area, as they've expressed on this program and
yes.
on other programs,
yes.
still do feel a real anxiety about how they are perceived, particularly Muslims of Middle Eastern descent, particularly in places like Kansas City, where they represent a very small percentage, a very small minority of the population.
We're talking about the top religion news stories of 2011. If you have a recommendation or a question for our very good panel, you can call right now, 816-235-2888. Our email address is up to date at kcur.org or go to KCUR's Facebook page. Paul Rauschenbusch from the Huffington Post, you've already mentioned Harold Camping here, and this is in connection with the end of the world. And your entry here goes this way: in order to give people time to repent, people with May 21st Judgment Day signs start popping up well before the announced date of the end of the world. The prophet of this apocalypse was Harold Camping, an elderly man with a drawling voice heard most prominently in his family radio empire. Who is Harold Camping, and what happened on May 21st, Paul?
Well, kind of, slightly, as I mentioned, oddly, disappointingly, nothing happened on May 21st. But what was really fascinating was how many people became interested in May 21st. I mean, this became a huge story. I mean, it was the biggest story that I had ever run on Huffington Post up to that moment. It was
really
bizarre. And I think what was really interesting about it was how people were willing to trust so much that they would give up everything just to, you know, based on this, you know, the kind of ramblings of this this voice on the radio. And that was just a kind of a depressing story, but also a very real human story. And some, you know, I wrote a piece at the end of it, like desiring the end of the world. What about us wants something to cataclysmically change? And so I thought it's a fascinating story. Harold Camping then, of course, on May 23rd or something, said, well, it kind of did happen, and it's really going to go down in 6 months. And then that didn't happen, and he got a stroke, and he's really, you know, that was the end of him. And it was really, it's kind of a tragic story in a way.
I have to admit, Brian Ellison, that May 21st came and went in my life. I'm not sure I was aware of Harold Camping's prognostication here. Was it on your calendar?
I was certainly glad to see you were still here on
yes,
Monday morning.
Yes, thank you.
Steve. Yeah,
no, maybe you alone.
But
yeah.
But I think Paul is right. I mean, we all, many of us, I guess, laughed a bit about this story and still can laugh about this story. But I will say that this is a story that I think really reflects our times in ways that maybe we're not comfortable acknowledging. Certainly, I think there's a sort of a perfect storm that happened. We are in a time of economic crisis. We're at a time when people feel vulnerable. Maybe folks are feeling like the world is in a very unsettled place from a national security standpoint, or even the political system in disarray. And one leader emerges with words that strike some as true, and a movement begins. And I think it actually does tell us something that's important about what happens in a time when people who are feeling poor, feeling vulnerable, are looking somewhere for hope, and it may be a false hope.
Yeah, interesting. Kevin, coming back to your list here, you point out number four, the Catholic Church introduces a new translation of the Roman Missal throughout the English-speaking world, making the first significant change to a liturgy since 1973. Why is this such a big story?
Well, I think Paul talked about this a little bit,
yeah.
But what this is this is the most direct encounter that most Catholics have with their church, is the words that they hear at Mass, and that's assuming that they go to Mass. And we've had some studies this year saying that maybe not so many of them actually do. But what this is, that, I mean, the Roman Missal is essentially the how-to book to the Mass, and it lays out the prayers that are spoken and the responses and what is said when and where and why, and they changed it to become more faithful to the original Latin text. And in the process, they changed the words. And they changed them in some kind of strange ways. So there's words like ineffable and
consubstantial.
Consubstantial. Yes. Yeah. And some really.
What's that word again? Consubstantial, which
instead
means
instead of one being with the Father, consubstantial.
Okay.
With the Father, yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Brian.
Yeah, and they're words that don't really roll off the tongue fairly easily. And I think that the question that a lot of Catholics had this year is why. Like, why are we changing it? The Mass seems to work just fine for us. You know, I don't understand why we need to change it. And the response from the church was, well, we're going for fidelity to the original text. And a lot of people said, well, I don't really quite get why we need to do that either. Because, you know, the last time they changed the Mass in the late 60s, early 70s, the desire was to make it more accessible to people, to make it so that they could understand it more and so that they could feel they could participate more. And people got that and they really jumped onto it. This one kind of went over sort of flat because nobody could really buy into the reasons for the change.
Did it make your list this time, Paul?
It did, yeah. And I think that, you know, again, I think it reveals a certain – we ran a poll, you know, very informal sort of like, do you like this mask better? Do you like the old mask better? Don't care. And there was interesting, a lot of comments saying, we want to go back to the Latin, which is really, you know, the question of the kind of the shows this struggle within the Catholic Church of like, where do people really want to be? And the question is do people want to go back pre-Vatican II? Where a lot of these reforms were made.
Hey, how much reaction was there to this locally, nationally? Any sense out there, gentlemen, what we heard, Brian?
Well, there was an article in the Star the day after the new language debuted, and it was filled with a whole lot of sort of head shaking on the part of both priests and parishioners, actually. Priests acknowledging that they're going to stumble over the words for a while because they've been saying them this way for
the
last
word, whatever
years.
You threw out, that's a mouthful.
I think, to be honest, Steve, what's most fascinating to me about this story is that it indicates that the Catholic Church is going almost exactly the opposite direction of where many churches today are going in the United States, where they're actually trying to sort of strip away pieces of their tradition that are found to be inaccessible to people. A new hymnal comes out, and they've taken out some of the beloved old hymns and replaced them with some that they think will connect with a new generation. Or they've updated their language in prayer books, and that's even in the ones that have prayer books. Of course,
right.
You know, many growing churches don't use liturgy really at all. And so that's what's so fascinating to me about this is that it's a real different approach to reaching a new generation.
Well, Kevin Ekstrom, again, editor-in-chief of the Religion News Service, joining us from Washington this morning. Number 6 on your list, staying with the Roman Catholic theme here, Pope John Paul II is beatified, the last step before sainthood, in a May ceremony attended by more than a million people in Rome. Why does the Vatican have John Paul II on the fast track here?
Well, that's a good question, and there's not a whole lot of answers. I mean, the official response is, well, we have a miracle that we've certified due to his intercession, so therefore he qualifies to be a saint. But I think there is a sense within the Catholic hierarchy, and this is really the hierarchy in Rome, that they're bending to popular will on this one. I mean, before John Paul was even buried, literally, there were people crying out for him to become a saint because he was so well-loved, and for a good chunk of the Catholic world, he was the only pope that people ever knew. And so the fact that he was beatified was always a question of when, not if. And, you know, he was beatified, 6 years after his death, which is rapid time in the Catholic Church. And so a lot of people were saying, well, are we rushing to this too soon? And do we need, you know, the help of history to sort of help us make a better assessment? So I would be willing to gamble a little bit that the step between now and when he is formally made a saint might take a little bit longer just to give it the process a little bit more breathing room.
Yeah, Paul, do you see this the same way? This is a response to such a popular sort of sense about Pope John Paul II?
Yeah, I think that's right, and there is a lot of pressure to do it, and I'm not sure that there's an appreciation for what normally happens with these kind of things and what sainthood means. I think it, you know, for many Catholics, it just means we really like him a lot, and so I think Kevin's got this right.
And what does sainthood mean? Is there more to it than I'm thinking here, Paul?
Well, I think you're kind of elevated to kind of the pantheon in some ways, and you can be prayed to. It's a very elevated position, which as a Protestant we don't have, but it's incredibly valuable within the liturgical and prayer life of Catholics.
Yeah. If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking again about the top religion news stories of 2011 with KCUR's Brian Ellison, Paul Rauschenbusch, senior religion editor for the Huffington Post, and Kevin Ekstrom, editor-in-chief of the Religion News Service. Kevin, again, another very interesting one here, a book by Michigan megachurch pastor Rob Bell, Love Wins is the title, presents a much less harsh picture of hell than is traditional, stirs discussion in evangelical circles. Messengers to the Southern Baptist Convention rebut it. What do you make of the whole thing?
It was sort of one of the most fascinating kind of public theology debates that we've seen in a long time. And it was so interesting about it was it gets to some very real, very permanent questions about, you know, what happens after we die. And for the longest time, I mean, for centuries and millennia, I mean, the traditional answer is, well, you go one of two places. You go to the good place or the bad place.
Mm-hmm.
And that's easy for people to understand. This time, Rob Bell comes along and says, well, maybe that bad place isn't really what we thought it was, or maybe it's not quite as bad as we think it is, or maybe not everyone who's there is actually there, or the people we think are there aren't actually there. So he raised some sort of profound but very simple questions about something that a lot of people have taken for granted for a long time. And you can tell the staying, you know, you can tell the importance of something like this by the fact that the Southern Baptist Convention immediately rejected it. And the Southern Baptists don't reject anything out of hand that quickly unless they're dead serious about it. And what a lot of sort of institutional Christian figures were concerned about that was that it was making a very black and white issue way too gray, or moving it from black to white. And so you saw, I think, the reaction from kind of the institution, for lack of a better term, was just as fascinating as Rob Bell's initial proposition.
You know, Brian Ellison, this is so interesting because none of us really knows the answer to this. Why such a strong reaction in your view here?
Well, I think part of it is not just what Rob Bell was saying, but who was saying it. As far as the what of what he says, there's most of what he's written has appeared before. I mean, he's questioned whether hell is a geographic location or a spiritual place, whether it's a state of being that can occur even during life and not just a place you go after you die. He raises questions about whether it's whether those lakes of fire, eternal torment images are consistent with what the rest of what the church and the Bible teaches about God. But those are all things people have said before. What I think is different in this story, and the reason it got the reaction it did, is that Rob Bell is a rising star of certainly seen that way in much of the evangelical community, and certainly as part of the movement that is sometimes called the emergent church, that is seeking to reach a new generation and connect with culture in a way that that affirms culture as a place where the church, where Christianity can exist, and with him saying this and then giving ground to a more what might be perceived as a more liberal theology or a less fundamental theology, that's what really seems to have triggered the reaction, certainly from the Southern Baptist Convention and from a lot of his fellow megachurch pastors who very quickly put him at arm's length and distanced themselves from him.
Paul Rauschenbusch, one of the issues on your top list of the top religion news stories of 2011, the struggle for the soul of yoga. Tell me, what's that all about?
Well, that was a bit of a vanity, but it was an interesting story. Some conservative Christians came out saying, Christians should not be doing yoga because is evidence of how influential yoga has become in our society, that many churches actually hold yoga classes. And this is not exactly a new story. What was new about it was the Hindus kind of chiming in and saying, well, yeah, you're right, actually. Yoga is a Hindu thing, and you should know it's a Hindu thing, and we're going to tell you why it's a Hindu thing, which is actually the more interesting part of the story, which is the kind of flexing of the Hindu lobbyist, Hindu voice in American society. And there's been a few kind of new Hindu organizations that are in Washington kind of putting forth Hindu, kind of concerns, and also who are trying to create a voice for Hinduism in America, which is a very hard thing to do because it's such a disparate sort of religious tradition. But that was kind of, the interesting kind of collection of voices and how much emotion it raised on all sides, and that became a very, very big story on the site for a while. Were these kind of debates between people who are saying Hinduism is for yoga is for everyone, it doesn't have a religious affiliation, and yet both Hindus and more conservative Christians were saying no, yes it does, and we're going to acknowledge that.
I think we'll leave that that one right there, Brian.
Well, I was going to say, I consulted my favorite Starbucks barista / yoga instructor this morning on this topic, and he says yoga is for everyone. So,
okay.
Everyone's welcome.
We're going to leave it right there. Well, Kevin, you both selected the Presbyterian Church in this country allows local option on ordination of partnered gay people. Church defections over the issue continue among mainline Presbyterians, Lutherans, and Episcopalians. What do you make of it, Kevin?
The Presbyterian Church was sort of the last one over the fence on this. Mm. Other churches have already done this, and Presbyterians, I'll let Brian try to explain how they do things, but they took them a lot longer, a lot more debates to get there. But what I'm looking at actually is in 2012, the United Methodists, which are much bigger, much more, much broader, they're going to be taking this up again. And they are really the last holdout within the mainline church on allowing gay clergy. And the big issue that's facing them is reflective of a shift in the culture where there are Methodist ministers who want to marry gay couples because they can get legally married in 6 states. And the church up until this point has said no, but we're going to see in 2012 whether or not they try to carve a little wiggle room there, or if they, what I would gamble, are probably likely to toe the traditional line on this one again.
Brian, how much effect in the Kansas City area have you seen here?
It is having some impact. I know, full disclosure, Presbyterian minister here, many of my colleagues are seeing some families leave their churches. We've even had a couple ourselves. But I will say that the bigger impact seems to be on whether this is going to be an ongoing debate. And certainly the issue of same-sex marriage is going to keep coming up. It will be on the agenda this summer at the next Presbyterian General Assembly. And I think we have yet to see what the long-term impact will be.
Okay. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for a very interesting conversation. I was glad to have all of you today. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Great to be with you.
Brian Ellison is a member of the Religion News Writers Association and pastor of Parkville Presbyterian Church. Paul Rauschenbusch is senior religion editor of the Huffington Post. And Kevin Ekstrom is editor-in-chief of the Religion News Service. Tomorrow on the program, Johnson County librarians share some great books for kids of all ages. Our music is by Bobby Watson and the UMKC Conservatory of Music Concert Jazz Band. We had help today from KCUR's Danny Alexander, Suzanne Hogan, and Maria Carter. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.